Like
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Mod State Podcast. This is the, I don't know what episode it is. We're close to 160 though.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, cool. We're just trucking through the hundreds, aren't we?
Just living the life of Caligula.
Well, I wouldn't have it any other way. Well, so this is a... And we haven't done this for a few episodes, so I'll just go ahead and shout it out. For those of you who are listening domestically in the United States, and for those of you abroad in different corners of the globe, thanks for tuning into the Mod State Podcast. Anywhere that you get it, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, FM, Podomatic, of course. And then, yeah, anywhere else you get getting your podcast, we appreciate you tuning in. And, of course, head over to modstate.com for more op-ed and opinion pieces, as well as links to the podcasts as well. So, needed to get that out. Can't forget you, the people who keep coming back and listening to this ridiculous banter. But yet necessary, banter week in and week out. So I wanted to jump into this pretty quickly because this is a bit of a continuation from the last podcast that we did about the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh, Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
We're like Rick and Daryl, The Walking Dead. It's totally different. It's just different, you know.
Yeah.
So, to be continued.
So if at the end of the 157th episode, I said we should stop here because this is going to be the continuation episode. So if you haven't listened to that, or you don't care to listen to it because you already know whether the status of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, at least just listen to the last 10 minutes. And it's sort of a segue into this podcast episode. And if you don't, you'll be all right. Any time we all spend together,
I feel like is time well invested. So I support this.
Good.
This musicology and the sorcery of yours.
So I, at the end, precast in between the last episode and this episode, I said that I was going to propose something to you without telling you. And it, there's no gotchas. There's no backing into a corner. It's literally just, a thought. And this stems from a podcast that I'm almost done with, but it is on the Waking Up podcast with Sam. Well, this is Sam Harris, and I know
it's not ongoing.
What's that?
It's not ongoing.
Well, it is an ongoing podcast, but I'm finishing the episode.
Oh.
Yeah, and I know that some people have specific feelings about Sam Harris, but it's really his guest that he had on, and that's Yuval Noah Harari, who is a professor, world history professor, and the author of several books, one of them being Sapien, where he does a dive into the beginning of humanity, namely Homo sapiens. He's got three books. I'll link them in the show notes. I still have to actually read them. I'm in the middle of a leadership class through the company I work for, and so I'm caught up reading books there. But as soon as I'm done, I'm going to read. I've got several books.
You should be teaching that class, Nate.
I don't know.
I think it's a critical portion of your future is going to be teaching some leadership.
Maybe. We'll see. I hope so. Coaching would be pretty cool. But
Pretty cat the Mod State will suffice.
Well, I mean, it could be within that. I don't know. We'll see how it works out. But Yuval Noah Harari, I believe, currently is a world history professor in at a university in Jerusalem, I believe. And again, I'll also, I'm not going to link the podcast show notes because in the show notes because you can just look up the Waking Up podcast and you should be able to find it. It's episode 138. But in, I like, obviously, an individual that got you and I talking, not him specifically, but the books that he wrote was George Freeman, who is the founder of Stratfor out of Texas, who is a really looks at the current happenings in the world based on history and geopolitics. Well, Yuval Noah Harari actually takes it one step further in a way and looks at world history. And he doesn't really express history as history, but he brings it into the present in terms of change. He calls it, I call it change. And he proposed something on this podcast episode that I thought is a good segue from the last episode, the 157th episode. And you had said, really, is the great experiment failing? And you put that in terms of cultural fabric, the lack of civility, and, of course, the mounting national debt that we accumulate, which I think is something that we need to examine more and more, and as progressives want to push forward policies that will be, the burden will be on the national debt, for example, universal health care, that this becomes, is the great experiment failing? Now, I made some proposals in the 157th episode where I said, hey, look, I don't think this is the great experiment failing. I think we can look to different cultural points in our very recent American history and say that I think there are more points of contention then than there are even today, and that those points of contention in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, that we look back on history and find that most of that was fairly positive. And whether that's learning how to take care of our soldiers from the failings of the Vietnam War, whether that was the civil rights in 1965, et cetera, et cetera.
So, steroid used by baseball players.
I just make their own league, dude. I'd watch it. But Mr. Harari brings up an interesting point. And that is, if the great experiment is failing, then there's obviously two sort of roads that we can take here. Well, this is my thought. There's really two roads we can take in terms of the great experiment failing. And that is, there's either the apocalypse, quite frankly, and or the current liberal democracy that we have today changes, and or there's an adaptation of this said liberal democracy that we have, or something new. And in terms of world history, and this is Mr. Harari speaking, he says, look, there are just certain types of governance that just aren't possible in certain periods of time. For example, the rise of communism in China, in Russia, and in other parts of the world would have never been possible in the 16th, 17th, 18th, and even 19th century. Because in order to have successful communism, and in for lack, we'll just throw this in there, even maybe a very tightly regulated socialist society, that you need, in order to, in a perfect communist society, not a dictatorship or an authoritarian like communist society, that you need to be able to control, i.e. where the wheat goes. You need to have technologies available to you to be able to distribute things equitably, to be able to know what you have as resources, to be able to, for example, have transportation, to be able to move people, to be able to move food products, even technologies that need to be built by the people to build up your society and your infrastructure. Those things would have never been possible in, let's say, a dictatorship, monarchy, or city-states that transpired maybe thousands of years before communism hit.
What his point is that a federal representative republic, representative democracy is antiquated?
No, he didn't.
Answer two. There's two doors, one of which is apocalypse, or two is that we go sort of as I mentioned before, I forget how far back it was, but sort of a more parliamentary style of government.
Who knows? Yeah, and he did not, for example, he just in his defense, if no one listens to the Waking Up podcast and his narrative there, he didn't, nowhere did he say that our liberal democracy is on the demise. He did not. He was just merely
how he answered door two, or like,
well, so that the door one and door two was more my articulation. That was not his. That was
well,
mine.
So I mean, what's your thought on that?
So it's interesting because obviously door
versus adaptation.
Yeah, door number two would be a form of adaptation. And I think that, for example, if we look at liberal democracy, there's a couple things that are sort of important to look at here. The one being that if technology is something that truly does drive our ability to change or have a more functional government, whether that's online voting, et cetera, I mean, there's things that truly are helpful that could be a positive for liberal democracy. Or as we move forward and we have these great changes, is there a possibility that liberal democracy is antiquated? Now, this sounds like revolution. This sounds like something crazy that I'm talking about right now. But when you really look at the ebbs and flows of governance and the type of people that have controlled or had power, or the people having power, et cetera, over humanity or over our time as walking this earth, you know, it's actually more statistically probable that you'll see these type of governance ebb and flow. And of course, we probably won't be around for some massive change like that. But I think thinking outside the box, as it's happening today, it's not really happening in terms of different political ideologies, like democratic socialists, which is really kind of a socialist platform, isn't a new thought process. But it does show, even though it's you could argue that it is also an antiquated or just a kind of an old governance style that is socialism. That, you know, still
the Republic is nothing new.
The Republic is nothing new, but the type of governance that we have in the United States currently today is really our own brand. And how does that, in terms of voting rights, in terms of access to voting, in terms of representation, it's just different from other republics.
I'll promise you this, any sort of apocalyptic scenario does not end with Americans being more free.
That is very true.
Now, they can do with that what they want, and whether I would approve of whatever revolution or another, I would tell them to go back to point A that I just made. There will be a select few, as usually happens with such events, if we look throughout history, happened even with the American Civil War, with who profited off of it. It wasn't the lower 98% that were enlisted. You know, so I think everyone needs to take a long, hard look at themselves in the mirror on this issue as well, and looking at how far are they willing to go to bring about change, and accepting the fact that this country, yes, I'm sure they are aware and even want it to be so, that it's no longer the same. Be careful what you wish for, because again, I don't see that resulting in something that's going to make Americans more free. Mm-hmm. Do with that what they will.
Yeah,
adaptation, again, we've discussed before, going to a more parliamentary style where, you know, there is no limit on the amount of parties that might be on the floor of the House. We wouldn't have a House of Lords, obviously. We would just have, you know, the House of Representatives, I guess we would call it. But, and you'd have a prime minister and a minister of whatever. But it would take a lot to make something like that happen, but the benefits would be having snap elections if we realized we'd made a dreadful mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in a way, it's, you know, I think, to me, I think more representation is probably more beneficial than just some other major party taking over. And I think in terms of the change that we would like to see in the United States is, I think most people want to see a doing away with the two-party system that has so much control and so much power, and we're seeing
that. Israel have had as many as 13 parties with members represented.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and there's another factor into this, and this was Harari's other point that I'd like to bring up, and because
you should bring up Harari's other point.
I should. I'm going to, because it plays into a little bit of the fracture and the things that we see in terms of bringing jobs back, whether that's democratic socialists bringing back manufacturing, or that's conservatives bringing back manufacturing, or bringing back coal, et cetera, is that he said, listen, in the way that representation, or rather the way it has worked in the United States since, we'll just say, the 19th century into the early 20th century, prior to, let's say, kind of the Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, If anyone hasn't read that, that's kind of about meat packing plants in. I mean, you can go and read it. It's a classic novel. It's kind
of
hard to
get through. Unsafe at any speed of its time.
Yeah. so the difference then, there's a difference. There was a need that the workers at the time had a their major issue at the time, and this plays into technology, is that they ran the risk of exploitation, and that was the major issue at the time, was being exploited. And the people in power, whether that was big business, whether you want to say that was government, still needed those people. They were relevant. So it was easier that the people felt needed. They, whether or not their status at work, the working conditions were bad or not, there wasn't an irrelevance.
They were staring at UBI. They weren't facing possibly a universal basic income.
No, really what it came down to was good working conditions and fair pay. So it was more exploitation. Whereas today, a major issue that we run into, whether that's because of social media, whether that's because of automated technologies in manufacturing sectors and throughout the world, that's computers in certain jobs where you might not be needed, that we are more concerned as a society culturally today as being irrelevant instead of exploited. When you're exploited, and I mean this in sort of an...
He's pointing that at Donald Trump?
Well, no. So, I mean, we can talk about...
Speech to the UN saying he's tired of the U.S. being exploited. I mean, where's he going with that?
No, no. So this is in terms of the people, of what pushes culture and what creates fractures, right? So in a dictatorship, those who are exploited, the dictator can't just round everybody up and shoot them because he needs those workers. I mean,
it would make the day interesting when he had to do all the work himself.
Exactly. For those people who are irrelevant, it doesn't matter if they're there or not. So if we're dealing with irrelevance today versus exploitation, then that is obviously going to shift culture, and that's obviously going to create the sort of fractures that we see today, especially in terms of a base that the Democrats walked away from, and they walked away from those protections. They walked away from the blue-collar worker. So if the overwhelming cultural issue is irrelevance, then Donald Trump 100% of the time steps up and says we're bringing coal back, and those people who feel irrelevant are going to vote, even if it's against their interest, for the person that's going to bring their jobs back. So, I mean, this has political implications, this has strategy implications, but it also has...
they would probably rank a job as amongst their chief interests.
Well, of course. And the Maslow hierarchy of needs is the job that provides the base for those needs. So, but I mean, in terms of maybe big business and the potential exploitation there, but the whole point here is irrelevance. And I think if we're dying for that, if we're yearning for that, if we need that on some unconscious level, you know, you're absolutely going to vote for the person that wants to make you relevant. So I just think that specific thought has implications for moving forward and possibly explains where we might be moving in the future when it comes to truly AI. Let's even just the automation in Detroit, where I live, the automation of those factory lines, that people were out of jobs. And that, I mean, that happened even before I knew, could make memories that was starting to happen. So there's broad implications for this in terms of the fractures that we see today and why people feel disenfranchised. And it sometimes makes the case for, look, is this the country just trying to be progressive? Are we moving forward? Is the conservative ideology and values a dying value set that will be overtaken by the liberals? Will it become more than that? Will it become people fighting for, for example, the Democratic Socialist Platform, will that become really a last bastion, the last barricade that people will jump on because they've got specific values rolled into it, equitable pay rolled into it, universal healthcare. So it ticks all the Maslow's hierarchy of needs plus the ability for self-actualization, et cetera. So, you know, if we use that into the, if we put irrelevance into the equation, I believe that these fractures within the parties will continue to grow and grow.
There's always going to be, but that's the thing with emotional conflict, and that's kind of what he's driving at. There is a more psychological perspective sort of shift. Well, and I'm not saying that's any less relevant than looking at the economic, but that's the thing, is there's never any resolving any of that. There's never going to be a point of arrival for our generation or any other generation, but particularly our generation, because there's always a debate, ongoing discussion, but there's never a coming to the truth. And that's the time we find ourselves in, and this is the world that we've made. Okay, so I mean I get the potential boxes here, but that's kind of what I was driving at in the last episode, and referring to the, letting the dialogue descend to this level, because accepting any of this behavior, again, not that any one side accepts hooliganism amongst their own ranks, but accepting such behavior as unjustifies the mind, the means. And it's basically operating under the errant assumption that if you win and build utopia in your image, the barbarians you lose to help you win, they're just going to snap back out of it, and you know, you're not going to have a problem governing after you've formed revolution. But raise no more devils than you can put down here, and that's what I'm getting at, coming from the perspective of careful what you wish for, the general you here.
Yeah, and again, I'm not
before you destroy this. Before you have something to replace it with.
Yeah, and it also boils down to, I mean, I think there's, if you were to poll a few Democratic Socialists or have them listen to this podcast and listen to us talk about the national debt and this being more of the impending doom than any sort of cultural fissures that we see or fractures that we see or political ideological fractures that we see in this country, that this is truly going to be the downfall. People might think of us as fear-mongering or conspiratorial, et cetera, but I have to go on a limb and say that, you know, I agree that at some point this is unsustainable. It'd be sort of like someone in the early 2000s or late 90s saying that, look, man, in 10 years there's going to be a housing bubble and you're going to lose all your money, that they would have looked at him as conspiratorial, but then it happened. So we know these things can happen. The Great Depression wasn't fake. It's not a farce. It very much did happen. So there are potential economic there is a potential economic massive failure, if you will, apocalypse.
The reason that trumps anything else, in my view, and I could make a strong argument, a more protracted argument down the road, but all of these programs that we think are so important become very irrelevant if there's no functioning government, because it's a failed state, because we defaulted on our national debt, we became bankrupt, treasury notes became worthless. I mean, now that's going to change more than just America. That would change the globe. But that's the, and then civilization, when it falls, tends to fall quickly. I'm not trying to be a promote conspiracy here either.
Well, but I don't.
And the Romans didn't see the Visigoths taking them down.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily conspiratorial. I mean, it literally just is. It's a fairly viable economic theory, and it just is kind of is what it is. That it's a
you
huge potential.
That the hero of this movement, not more or less shrugging off the other $35 trillion she needed to come up with for her idea to be viable. Now she's got plenty of time. So she's 35, but to say the least, that was a little concerning, Nate, that nobody around her, nobody in with an earpiece into her ear said, hey, let's look at this number a little bit here. Let's come up with a better way of explaining this, you know, diving in headlong here. Mm-hmm. That's a little concerning. Yeah. But
well, on the flip side of that, and I to venture away from Mr. Harari's didn't mean to just like hijack the first part of this entire episode on that, or the almost half of this episode, but this is something I brought up in the middle of the precast for this episode, was that there's another part of the equation here, and that is, obviously, everyone looks at maybe the Democratic Socialist, and the reason I'm talking about this, folks, is because our midterm elections are coming up, and these are kind of emerging ideologies that we're seeing. We're seeing representatives win and
changes on the ballot.
Yeah. So, the one thing that I don't see is, well, what we do see with the, because of the Progressive Democratic Socialist movement, is a lot of these things. We want this, and this, and without that great of a plan. I mean, it's a fairly obvious plan. Like, what are you going to do? You're going to increase taxes on individuals, and
you eat the rich.
You eat the rich, and you're going to increase taxes. What I don't hear, however, is the flip side to this argument. And you see these arguments on subreddits. You see them sometimes on social media, Instagrams, with not that great of articulation. There's a lot of anger behind it, and I'm not upset by the anger, or I'm not taken back by it. I think people are just frustrated because they truly believe their economic theories, and they probably articulate it very well with amongst themselves. But to be able to articulate this sort of conservative fiscal message to other people who have felt disenfranchised or look at poverty through a certain lens, it's just, they're missing the mark. And that is that it isn't all that conservatives are pro big business and are for lower taxes and slashing welfare. There's what they're missing, their marketing campaign on how these fiscal policies would help someone move through the social and economic caste system, dare I say, in this country. They don't do a good job marketing it. They don't do a good job promoting it in a positive way, by really articulating to the people, this is our 10-step program to moving out of poverty. It's like
While we're at it, we're going to make homelessness illegal.
Exactly. So there's this heavy-handed governance and rule of law that goes along with the 10-step handbook to getting out of poverty. Now, I'm sure the Cato Institute or something like that has a 10-step guide to get out of poverty, or you can buy someone's book for $29.99 at Barnes & Noble's if you got the cash to buy it. But there really isn't any public service announcements.
It makes me feel better to talk about the article they wrote at cocktail parties that they're making a difference, Nate.
I'm just saying there's a mark being missed here because there is credence to that theory. There's credence to the argument that you could easily make a permanent welfare state with the progressive socialist democratic platforms that some of these new representatives are pushing forward. There's absolute credence to that argument. On the flip side,
it would be an out-and-out welfare state. Yeah. It would be a nanny state in the purest sense of the phrase. But again, in the long run, at some point, there's not some money tree that's being hidden here, folks.
Sure, but
it's at some point it becomes unsustainable to do all this while fighting wars in seven different countries. While, I mean, this is an entirely different podcast, but it's simply not. I don't care what. There's no numbers that work.
Yeah. So, but the thing with someone, whether they're looking at two economic theories, and they've got two pamphlets. They've got the guide out of poverty, or rather the guide to a sustainable life, and then they've got the 10-step guide to get out of poverty. They've got both of them, and they're like, look, man, I am done being stuck in poverty, or I'm done being stuck in the middle class. I want to move forward. And you've got these two economic theories. They want to be able to pay for food for their kids. They want to put shelter over their kids' heads and their families, and they got these two economic theories. The one thing that they're not doing is probably looking at the national debt. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't be. I'm just saying that's the reality of a vast majority of Americans out there, is that they're not looking at that end sort of apocalyptic nightmare.
Things they take for granted.
But the thing is this is where the conservatives miss the mark on a positive messaging for their economic theories for the betterment of someone in poverty or in that middle class portion. They're missing that mark. And
some of the proposals, for instance, from then Representative, it wasn't Speaker at the time, Paul Ryan, basically got all of the savings, quote, from assistance for the poor. And nothing about the fact that we've just audited the Pentagon for the first time in its history, which is outrageous in and of itself. But and I'm not being anti-troops here. I'm being anti-military-industrial complex here. At some point, we're fighting seven different armed conflicts right now. The trillion-dollar wars have got to stop. Just like the blank check for repeating the failures of the Great Society, in my mind, has to stop. We've all agreed that's the definition of insanity, continuing what has failed you, expecting a different result. You know, everybody agrees something has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of, okay, where to now, St. Peter? What? A lot of those things, in my mind, and it's not arrogance, it's just looking down the path and realizing, in terms of accounting 101, all right, there's no way to sustain this long term. Anybody that doubts that, just Google it, Bing it, whatever you use. Look up anything on our national debt, the sustainability. I mean, we're talking 2028 is when we're going to be paying $1 trillion a year in interest.
Man, I thought my new house.
How many programs could we fund with $1 trillion?
Nah. Yeah. I'm right there with you. Every time we talk about this, it's really hard for me to, it becomes difficult for me to, be as left-leaning as I can without that staring me in the face. And to me, it's not, my goal wouldn't be to create some utopia based on...
It is funny that both of the major sides, predominant sides in this argument, you raise a good issue that they both fumble the ball in a completely different way.
They do.
It's like back-to-back fumbles at the 50-yard line here.
Yeah, I think, I really do. I think there's fumbling on both sides in two different ways, just like you articulated it. But the lack of articulation, let's say, in the right, is...
Right, and to hell with the poor, more or less, is the way it's being perceived.
Okay, exactly. So
the left is saying to hell with the national debt.
Exactly. So you can see, just topically, how frustrating that is for each side, looking at the other side.
Everybody that doesn't firmly find themselves planted in one camp or the other, that just wants something done for the sake of the country.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Which way do we actually go?
I find myself.
So, myself as well. So it's interesting to look, if you can really break it down that way, where, I mean, it's just as, it's, it can be as simple as, hey, look, as not being the party or a person in the party who is trying to use capitalistic measures or fiscal conservatism to move people out of poverty or out of the middle class and move them up. But instead of recognizing the need for a bit of a welfare state in the current situation that we have right now, instead of recognizing that and trying to promote fiscal conservatism among individuals, they say, hey, look, we're going to drug test everybody on Medicare, Medicaid, on wealth, on CHIP, on any sort of government assistance. I mean, that's so counterproductive to pushing a positive message forward for the platform that you have.
So, like, well, I've said this before. I want the House and the Senate drug tested.
Yeah. I remember they're with you. How do you tell people that... we're going to take away your health care and you're one accident away from never, ever getting out of debt ever for the rest of your life or filing for bankruptcy.
You would get for being born poor. If you would have just worked harder.
While your representative or that individual who's lobbying for that or who is making an effort to take those.
Meanwhile, his little darlings that he and his wife have, or she and her husband have, they're not going through the same thing kids and my kids would go through.
Well, that and the absolute free health care that they have for the rest of their life. It's just two bizarre different worlds. It's Earth and it's Mars. And you can't
The difference is they want to tell you and I, dictate to you and I terms on how to live.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is it's hard, or it's not hard for me to make the leap. Or see why people make the leap to the Conservative Party being all big business and all garnering money for a certain amount of people and screw workers' protections. It's like when all these things sort of happen, instead of it, that's why people say they really don't care. They just need their votes to stay in power and accumulate wealth where they want it to go.
Yeah, the both sides just punt the branches back and forth, and
yeah,
the song remains the same.
Exactly. It's
just the view.
100%. So I didn't mean to completely... I don't know if that's the format we wanted for this podcast episode, but I just think it's another angle.
It gelled rather well. It is a different angle to look at.
And I think it's, regardless of psychology or economics, it is an important angle to look at in terms of how you get people on board or off board for fairly devastating potential economic theories.
You know, that's a emerging field of psychological economics.
I can imagine with the average millennial $30,000 in debt, not able to own their own home at the same rate.
Market motivations of the future are scary to look at.
Yeah. Anyway, I've been talking far too long, and I thought this was a good one. And
no, I think it was the right direction to go to. It hailed from a different angle, and it's one that needs to be elaborated on. It's not as simple as the two preeminent parties would have you believe, that it's just a choice. You know, if you just make the right choice out of the 50% crapshoot here, then all well. But it's the same message every election.
It really is. And I'll be curious to see, we've been talking about I feel like we've been talking about the midterm elections for so long, and then all of a sudden it's really right around the corner. And
so exciting.
That's exciting. Ooh.
James.
But I think what's sort of elevated these midterm elections has obviously been the nomination of another Supreme Court justice, which is kind of
sad.
Doesn't really happen too often together, but anyway, so I have to work early tomorrow. This has been an absolute pleasure, and I'm running out of voice. My voice is sort of, I think I'm coming
Don't
down
do
with something,
that.
But you certainly hard to podcast and lose your voice. So I'm going to drink some tea.
Don't do that. That's all in trouble.
Indeed. So as always, my friend, it's an absolute pleasure and honor. And so until next time,
au revoir.
We'll see you.